all the undercover, eavesdroppers and disinformation clever dips could have been more fruitfully employed pursuing a whole host of tantalizing leads rather than fabricating a climate of ridicule that discouraged their reporting. The government-sponsored propaganda campaign was a blunt instrument that not only camouflaged secret projects, it also choked off opportunities for a healthier multilateral dialogue. An extensive diplomacy might have evolved in which Earth's interests were advanced rather than jeopardized. Relationships could have been formed in which the leverage offered by cooperation, assistance and amity could have been used to moderate or terminate the less agreeable activities of other visitors. In other words, the application of good, old-fashioned diplomacy. A grand entente could have been pursued, a policy of safety in numbers, at the same time that the administration was being arm-twisted into an entente reticent with one group of visitors. But no such strategy appears to have been implemented on a sustained or effective basis. The benevolent humanities reported in the literature generally evinced a reluctance or refusal to share advanced technology for fear that it would be used for destructive purposes, of which they saw ample evidence in their terrestrial sightseeing. The only indication of an accord put in place in the United States was a blurry arrangement with a species of visitor whose nature and intent seemed incongruent with Earth's interests. An examination of the evidence, foggy though it is, suggests that these favored visitors were willing to assist in the transfer of technology in a military context. Was this transfer an irresistible inducement that led decision-makers astray? If the truth is otherwise and these uncomfortable inferences are unfounded, then we need MJ-12 to come out of hiding and give their side of the story. This is one of the problems of censorship. It cuts both ways. It not only hides the negative, but it can hide the positive as well, if such exists. There are any number of well-researched contact cases with human types which are convincing in their authenticity, the Billy Meier case in Switzerland, from the 1970s and ongoing, the Edwin White, equals Calder's, contacts near Durban, in South Africa, from the 1960s minus 1980s, the equals Norca contacts of the late H. Albert Coe, of Philadelphia, 1950s to 1980s, and the Adamski-Steckling contacts in the United States, 1952 to 1991. Other genuine cases have doubtless occurred, both reported and unreported. All of the above-named cases were, or are, long-running repeat contact relationships which could have been exploited to deepen an official relationship. They all involved friendly visitors whose goodwill and willingness to help seemed beyond question. The intimate and trusting nature of these remarkable exchanges with private individuals meant that the relationships which had been established were probably amenable to carefully negotiated third-party involvement. The cost of entry for government people knocking on the door would have been sincerity, tact, patience and non-threatening diplomatic body language. Needless to say, the purpose of the involvement would have had to have been peaceful, productive and unrelated to military gain. The goodwill in all of these cases was conspicuous. In most, there was an indication that unilateral action had already been taken by the visitors to prevent or ameliorate man-made environmental problems or catastrophes. Both in the Meier case and the Coke case, their contacts inferred that they had interceded technically to prevent certain nuclear bomb tests from becoming self-sustaining reactions that could have consumed the planet. Coe's people advised him that they had spent many years developing what they called a magnetic drain-off screen to prevent runaway nuclear reactions. They stated that this high-altitude neutralizer was activated on the planet-wide basis on the 11th of February 1958. Interestingly, this date coincides with one of the most remarkable auroral displays of the 20th century, an unusual red aurora, which was seen from Canada to Los Angeles and throughout Europe, where it caused widespread public concern. The ETs and the South African equals Calder's contacts said that in 1970 they had openly accompanied the crippled Apollo 13 module for much of its return journey from the Moon and would have rescued the three astronauts inside had their craft become incapable of safe return. They even played to Edwin White, the main contactee, and his inner circle a recording of the astronauts' exclamations when their flying saucer hove into view. These same visitors also stated that they had carried out extensive logistical planning to evacuate and house elsewhere a large number of people should Earth be overtaken by a geological or nuclear cataclysm. Mir's contacts warned him forcefully and repeatedly about a whole range of burgeoning environmental problems, including the hole in the ozone layer which they said, in February 1975, had been degraded by bromine gases over their 60-year study period by an average of 6.38%. This warning in the early stages of the ozone depletion debate highlighted the key role of bromine, whose damaging impact was only identified in the scientific literature 4 months later in June 1975. Mir's visitors advised him that, ironically, the most dangerous form of nuclear tests, in their opinion, were underground tests, where the possibility existed of uncontrolled fission reactions spreading to certain natural ground materials. But when it came to nuclear explosions, there were no easy options. George Adamski reported that his visitors had been using a type of green ball, sent out from their craft, to counteract or neutralize concentrations of radiation created through atom bomb tests in the atmosphere. Such green equals fireballs were seen frequently around the Eck test site in New Mexico, and were the subject of an official U.S. Army study in the late 1940s. The Calder's contacts warned of a complex, carbon-based chemical brew in the Earth's ionosphere that had been triggered by nuclear bomb tests and which threatened to become inflammable. Fine radioactive carbon particulate mixed with carbon from industrial and terrestrial sources, as well as naturally occurring carbon-14 and radioactive and non-radioactive carbon dioxide, had produced a critical situation. Over large areas, solar radiation had cooked this mix into a state of near inflammability. This situation teetered on the brink of ignition, which was almost certain to occur if nuclear warheads were exploded in or near this region in the atmosphere. Earth would progressively become a fireball over a period of several days, they said. The visitors reported that on a few occasions they had intercepted and rendered harmless guided missiles with explosive warheads that had been meant to explode at high altitudes. The same people gave a warning about global warming and the melting of the ice caps in a contact in November 1980. This caution occurred at the very early stages of the international debate on temperature change, before a strong consensus had formed about the Earth's warming trend. The wide-ranging benevolence that was indicated in these contact events, and in many others less well documented or publicized, suggests that it was common sense to build solid official relationships with the human ETs who displayed such a willingness to help. It made sense from every angle. Official relationships may possibly have occurred out of sight of public scrutiny with cases we don't know about. But in all but one of the above-mentioned friendly contactee connections, there is no evidence that such a formal and sensible government initiative was attempted. Even in this case, the Adamski contacts, the indications are ambiguous. There are reports that Adamski had off-the-record meetings with President John F. Kennedy during the Kennedy incumbency, 1960-63. These meetings were sometimes attended by the president's brother, Robert Kennedy. Both of these men are known to have had a personal interest in UFOs. Whether the get-togethers reflected active interest by MJ-12 and the administration or merely arose from the brothers' personal curiosity is not known. The latter seems possible, as the government interest did not survive Adamski's death in 1965. His successor, Fred Steckling, continued to have regular meetings with Adamski's equals boys for the next 26 years until his passing in 1991, but apart from a couple of meetings between Steckling and government officials in the mid-1960s, no systematic, or even occasional, liaison appears to have taken place thereafter. Edouard equals Billy Meier, in Switzerland, was the subject of wall-to-wall official surveillance, but there is no evidence to indicate that officialdom in any shape sought to use his contacts to open up lines of communication to the visitors. The Calder's ETs told White that they had endeavored to establish firm links, but these had been rebuffed. In pursuit of domestic stability, the Earth appeared to have turned itself into a galactic equals hermit state. This was the planetary equivalent of the Japanese Sakuku, equals locked country, period which barred foreigners and their alien cultural influences from Japan from 1639 to 1853. The Japanese shogunate allowed a crack in the wall with tightly controlled trading posts. In similar vein, Earth's most powerful government reached out a hidden backhand for technical know-how. There was a certain justification to this planetary isolationism. If 17th-century Japanese policies appeared heavy-handed, the alternative historical lessons of the 18th and 19th centuries showed their good sense. The potential for cultural devastation when technically advanced societies swooped down on unprepared communities was obvious to all students of colonial impact. When MJ-12 dropped the ball, there was no doubt that the grave dangers of the Cold War complicated any considerations of disclosure. There were life-threatening issues to worry about, and the arrival of the flying saucers turned out not to be a security threat. It was a largely benign, if sensational, development, and the messy business of disclosure could be safely postponed till later. The problem was that the Committee of Elders, who were the main policy advisors on this thing, dropped the ball. Hindsight is easy, but there was a wide window of opportunity that opened up when the conspiracy reached its 50th birthday in 1991. There was a certain symmetry to this year, an anniversary that spoke of timeliness, and a season finally arrived that was pregnant with possibility. This was the year that marked the final collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, when the Soviet Union broke up and ceased to be a viable military competitor to the United States. The dramatic easing of international tension that accompanied the end of the Cold War offered an obvious opportunity for carefully handled disclosure to take place. There was a 10-year period of strategic calm that was favorable for these purposes. It cried out for action from a president with courage and an eye for the main chance. Had disclosure taken place during this crucial decade, there is some reason to suggest that the event that brought it to a close, the 9/11 attacks, might not have occurred, and the rise of violent religious fundamentalism might have been blunted. Not only that, but the seemingly insoluble problem of carbon emissions and global warming could have been more vigorously and effectively addressed, while there was still time, perhaps with a little help from our friends. From the final years of the 20th century, the policy of suppression and isolationism begins to look less like prudent management and more like historical tragedy. These were the years when the linear flow of history cried out to be released from its man-made bottleneck. It was the crossroads where an alternative historical path for Earth, unconstrained by conspiracy and rigid provincialism, begins to look better than what actually happened. Precluded history was more attractive than the history we lived. It was the tipping point where the planet's culture, in its widest sense, that the cover-up was designed to protect, was no longer worth it. The concealment had outlasted its usefulness. Its equal's use-by date had passed, and suddenly the product it was designed to protect had gone off. A slow-motion ecological catastrophe was unfolding, the economic system was rent with cracks, and religious violence was mushrooming. It was no longer a healthy thing that our institutions and systems are being shielded from the wider context that galactic citizenship offered. It was a time when we were big enough and ugly enough to know the truth and to discuss and debate the way forward with all the facts on the table. The idea that the evolution of both nations and global affairs could be optimized and endowed with an orderly gradualism by turning inwards and presenting a hunched back to the universe was obsolete. The Arab equals spring of 2011 showed that sweeping, revolutionary move, meant that could change the face of nations and international relations could occur whether or not the planet was being exposed to winds blowing from elsewhere. Change is going to happen with or without phony policies of concealment. The narrow religious fundamentalism that prescribed the single God-given path for all at the point of a gun would not long survive the revelation that there were millions of other planetary populations, many of which were visiting Earth on a regular basis and demonstrating an admirable spirituality and success that owed nothing to our creeds. The demolition of the conceit that we were alone in the universe, and somehow at the top of the heap, would likely bring about a humble realization that religious conquest was for the birds. There just aren't that many bullets or bombs in the universe. And nor will we jettison our religions just because some ET professes a different one. The sages of MJ-12 can relent on their overweening paternalism. We are sufficiently conditioned to the likelihood of aliens existing to not freak out at confirmation of the fact. We don't discard our beliefs now when presented with another terrestrial theology. Why would we do it for a visitor from the stars? If our faith is that weak, then it's not a faith, it's a gloss, and conversion may be a good thing. All this will bring about a deepened appreciation of the place of diversity in the scheme of things and the importance and good sense of tolerance of other viewpoints. Tolerance becomes non-negotiable when the marketplace of peaceful ideas and philosophies expands dramatically. Nor will the announcement that ET exists cause social chaos, that other, old saw of plain thinkers. A huge slice of the planet's population has already seen through the conspiracy anyway, and there are no signs of people running through the streets foaming at the mouth and tearing at their clothes. Instead, half of them are checking out the latest UFO footage uploaded to YouTube. And who would reject a sustainable, pollution-free technology for transport and power generation if it was offered to us from trusting visitors? The likelihood is that it already exists anyway in the classified laboratories of military and civilian contractors who have cracked the code. It's simply being sat on while Rome burns. If visitors came to the rescue with a technical fix for the carbon problem, it's probable that agreed protocols and viable international governance structures would need to be put in place as a quid pro quo. Compensation to those nations and businesses adversely affected would also need to be considered. But there is a treasure chest of potential positives waiting for us on the other side of disclosure. It may mean the difference between merely surviving and succeeding. It's not a cop-out. Hushing it all up 70 years ago was a cop-out. When was asking for help ever a cop-out? That a community's problems must be solved from within that community is not holy writ. Such a blinkered viewpoint would invalidate the whole concept of international aid. We are all in this together, and it's only a delusion to think that we must be defined in planetary terms. In order for us to embrace this brave new world, President Obama needs to implement disclosure. His government through the decades has hidden the most. It now needs to admit the most. It needs to take the leadership, not just in suppression but in a prudent and overdue revelation. It is best that our most powerful and admired nation should take the primary role in this initiative. It should put right the self-inflicted infringements of its own remarkable charter, a document admired by all, and reassert its enduring values, ones that help safeguard people not just in America but throughout the world. It is time for President Obama to chart a new path, to speak to the American people and the people of the world on this vital issue. He should do it this year before the 2012 election gets in the way. But most of all, he needs to do it. He needs to make sure that power does not pass from his hands without this job having been done. If Barack Obama has an eye for his legacy, he must not follow his tongue-tied predecessors in the White House and become part of the problem. He needs to be part of the solution. The president most self-proclaimedly committed to the rule of law, openness and accountability needs to make a major public speech, and this is the sort of thing he needs to say: "At my inauguration as president, I declared that your government would do its business equals in the light of day, because only then can we restore and strengthen the vital trust between a people and its government that is the cornerstone of a healthy democracy. I said that America had prospered through its history not simply because of the skill or vision of those in high office, but because we, the people, had remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents. Today I wished to address myself to a few of the central principles that underlie our founding documents, namely freedom of speech and the vital necessity of our citizens, our legislature and our judiciary being fully informed of important matters that guide our national and international policy." Thomas Jefferson once said, "Equals, I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves, and if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. It is now my intention to take you into my confidence on an issue that is of concern to me and which the time is overdue that your government should share with the people it serves. I wish to inform your discretion, as Jefferson would say, by the disclosure of important information. When I succeeded to the presidency in 2009, it was brought to my attention by my advisors from within government that there had been a decades-long censorship of sensitive and amazing facts. This policy of suppression of remarkable discoveries that we had made was carried out for reasons which seemed reasonable and necessary at the time. These events were viewed as special circumstances requiring special discretion and confidentiality. The secrecy of these government activities was supported by many of my predecessors in the White House, and I have thought about these secrets carefully in the first few years of my presidency. I now feel that it is time that we should bring this unusual and unprecedented state of affairs to an end, and that I should reassert our constitutional principles of openness, accountability and freedom of information, that we should make the people once again the safe depository of our society's ultimate powers. I have made the irrevocable decision that this unsatisfactory situation that has endured for over 50 years should end today and that we should embark on a challenging new era. I refer to our government's policy on UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Many years ago, our government recovered craft that had visited Earth from outer space. Some call these objects flying saucers. We not only recovered these craft, which had crashed, but we also established a dialogue with some of the visitors. We began communicating with them. Over the course of many decades, these facts were withheld from the American people and the people of the world. Nor were our citizens taken into the government's confidence in the wide-ranging activity and extensive contact that our officials carried out with the visitors. I now inform you of these extraordinary facts and confirm that contact with extraterrestrials has been achieved by your government. I need to add that there is no cause for fear or panic. We found that our planet was being visited on a regular basis by people from outside Earth who came in peace, and I use the phrase equals people from outside Earth deliberately, because while some of the visitors are different from us in many ways, there are many who are similar or identical to the human race. Many look like us, many talk like us. That is the advice I have received from my officials who have been working in this area. I have asked my Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to progressively implement a policy of disclosure of the key facts of this business to the American people and the people of the world in the weeks and months ahead. Some will find the information to be released disorienting or even disturbing. Others will see it as a welcome opportunity for the citizens of the world to expand their horizons in a positive way. Others will find it a relief, especially those who have recognized over the years that the American government was not being honest with its citizens on this issue. I have been informed that the visitors are coming from many origins in space and that their activities have generally proven peaceful and non-threatening. In fact, in the communications which have occurred between the American government and the visitors, repeated expressions of friendship and goodwill have been conveyed to us. We have no reason to doubt these welcome signs of fraternity. It is time for our planet to take its rightful place in the galactic community, and for each one of us, in addition to our national allegiances and our identification with the planet we stand on, to ascend to a new citizenship. One unbounded by planetary limits and one which recognizes broader responsibilities and opportunities. We must not export into space those attitudes that have marred Earth's history and which continue today in acts of intolerance and violence around the planet. We are being called to a higher standard of behavior as a species. This event comes as an equals wake-up call for all those who think that we can continue to walk in the old paths of bigotry and confrontation. Realization of this profound transition in mankind's status is not a cause for disruptive or disturbing changes in the way we live. We will still get up tomorrow morning and go to work, we will still tend to our farms, take our children to school, watch the evening news and sit down and break bread with our family and friends. But in the weeks, months and years ahead, our political and social horizons, and our scientific endeavors, will be reshaped by new perspectives and new opportunities that this change in our circumstances brings. Open discussion, open debate and open science flowing from this dialogue with the visitors have the potential to significantly improve the way we cope with the pressing problems that our planet faces. In the ecological crisis that confronts us with seemingly insoluble symptoms, the problem of carbon emissions and global warming, we have the opportunity to draw on the opinions and experiences of others for the benefit of mankind. As the visitors have not posed a security threat to our planet, I have asked Secretary Clinton to lead the effort in maintaining our relations with the visitors. It is right and proper that this job should lie with the Department of State rather than the military. At all points she will work in consultation with the President, and there will be times when I will take the lead role, as the primary spokesman for our nation. The Secretary of State will conduct this diplomacy in consultation not only with the executive, but with Congress as well, as our Constitution requires. I have also asked her to bring together a consultative group of people from other nations to assist the United States in the conduct of this interplanetary dialogue. The Department of State will also work with the United Nations in achieving international consensus on the best way to advance this new diplomacy as it affects the international community. A word of caution. Common sense behavior should still apply in the unlikely event that people have a close encounter with the UFO or its occupants. The chances of this happening are extremely low, as we all know, but prudent caution should still be exercised, as it is our preference that the government should first confirm and formalize the arrangements with the various visitors before widespread or unscheduled contact takes place. With that proviso, I believe that we can move forward to a new and promising era of cultural contact on an interplanetary basis. It is time that the breeze of wider views, wider perspectives, and a wider tolerance and humbleness flowed across our planet. Yes, we must preserve all that is good and appropriate in our societies and cultures. And yes, our customs and creeds and our social and economic arrangements, which serve us well and are sustainable, should be maintained. The sorry history of damage and injury inflicted on societies by more technologically advanced peoples is well known to all students of colonial impact. We must not fall into the same trap. For that reason, I caution all people about an unrealistic and submissive reaction to those who may come from beyond Earth. There is still much that is good and wholesome and just about the way that we behave and conduct our lives. Our culture is rich and unique, and always will be. But we must also have the good sense to open our minds to other viewpoints and other values that successful societies elsewhere hold. We must come together in a harmonious dialogue marked by mutual respect and constructive intent. Interesting days lie ahead. In conclusion, let me say that our government will be measured and peace-abiding as we traverse this new frontier of diplomacy. And I commend to my fellow Americans and the people of the world that they respond in like manner to the news that I have given today, with composure and a peaceful expectation, with tolerance and goodwill toward others no matter where they should hail from. It is a time for calmness, a time for hope, and a time for humility in the challenging and promising days that lie ahead. Chapter 3, From Prudence to Tragedy. Should I go public? That was the question that Dr. James E. McDonald put to his colleagues at the University of Arizona in the mid-1960s when he was wrestling with the idea of making widely known his interest in UFOs. For 8 years, McDonald, a senior physicist and professor of meteorology at the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, had been quietly investigating UFO sightings in the Tucson area and was convinced that the phenomenon was genuine, thought-provoking, and often inexplicable in conventional terms. In 1966, when the Michigan UFO flap drew a series of lame explanations from Air Force spokesmen, McDonald had had enough. He put his academic and professional reputation on the line and launched into high-profile research and lobbying. Thus would begin a remarkable one-man campaign that would reach into America's most prestigious academic and professional institutions, as well into the corridors of Congress, before it came to a tragic end in 1971. McDonald trained in meteorology at MIT and was a brilliant researcher. In addition to a busy life as a father of 6 children, he went on to establish an impressive track record in pure research and publication. A bibliography compiled after his death tracked the publication or preparation of 231 articles, papers, or published letters. A friendly manner enabled the lean, Crew cut McDonald to mix easily with both professional colleagues and ordinary people. This warmth and knack for engagement at the personal level stood him in good stead with witnesses in over 600 UFO cases that he investigated. The neglected flying saucer phenomenon was a sitter for McDonald. "He had probably the most curious mind of anyone I'd ever met in my life," said a fellow professor at Arizona University.